Well, happy Friday, everyone. Tamara here, your host and the person totally obsessed with human innovation and performance. So, today's podcast, I'm actually bringing you something in reverse. This is actually me being interviewed by one of the everyday innovators and actually one of our Innovation Quotient Edge partners. So, she's a rock star in many ways. She's certified in the IQE methodology and all our human and performance methodology. And she, Chris Chopiak is her name. And she is actually a master at visual strategy. So she's actually interviewing me for a client that she's working with that she had them take the IQE and they're going to do a bunch of teamwork with. And I wanted to bring you this interview because we touch on a lot of different subjects around innovation and cultures of innovation and what sabotages innovation. So there's a lot of depth and there's a lot of insights in this interview. And Chris is an absolute rock star. I adore her. All right, let's get to it.
Hello, everybody. My name is Chris Chopiak. I am the CEO and founder of a company called Arlosol Visualize Innovation. And we specialize in combining strategic visuals. Yep, that's right, pictures with pictures with really good facilitation and using a design thinking and innovation framework to help our clients do more, be successful, and set themselves up for whatever their next thing is. And this is kind of unusual for me because it's usually my friend Tamara doing the questioning and I'm doing the answering, but we flipped it this time to talk to her a little bit about the IQE assessment and her company, the background on IQE, where companies get stuck, and how people can use innovation to actually achieve more, a better success, high performance, and actually get better and different results. So, Tamara, thank you so much for being here to talk with us a little bit about the IQE and your backstory and your experience.
Well, thank you. And I gotta say, Chris, I always love talking to you because you ask me really challenging questions that make me think differently. And I know you do that for your clients too. And that, in a lot of ways, is the foundation of innovation, right? It's just a little bit of a shift in perspective. So I always appreciate our conversations because I never know what you're gonna ask me.
Okay, so no surprises here. So I think a good place to start is, can you give us a little of the backstory around the IQE, and then what was your original intention as you looked at innovation and what people had and didn't have and your own innovation experience? Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
So let me give a little bit of the backstory because it kind of was a circuitous path that all came together, these kind of different experiences that brought out the IQE. And I want to start actually early on in my career with an experience I had that I think really set the stage for why I became so obsessed with how we as humans innovate. Not just the process of innovation, the tools we use, the culture we're trying to build, but really we as humans, individually and as teams, how we innovate. So early on in my career, in fact, right after college, I moved to New York City because I really wanted to get a job on Madison Avenue in advertising. Because at that time, it was 1995, so just to date myself, that's where all the good creative was coming from. So I landed a job at the second largest global advertising agency, Young & Rubicam. Now, Chris, I was an account coordinator, which means I was the lowest of the low of the low of the totem pole. So I was lucky if I made coffee and made copies for people, right? That was it. That was my job. But I had a boss that thought I could take on more. So she pulls me into her office one day and she says, "Tamara, I'm going to put you in charge of the big strategic meeting. I want you to be the one to get everybody together and make this happen." Now, Chris, this was the meeting where we set the creative, the advertising strategy for the year to come. This is what dictated all of our advertising, our media buy, like everything we did came out of this meeting.
Wow.
I felt like my career was on the line. I was so nervous. So here's the thing. I needed to get everybody there, right? So our clients, obviously on the brand, the account management team that I was on, and anyone else who touched the brand. So the people in accounts payable, the people in the media buy who bought advertising agency, anyone that touched our brand. But most importantly, I had to get the creatives there. And not just any creative, I needed to get Steve. Now, Steve was the guy with that amazing, magical, aha, creative brilliance, right? And you just, he just walked down the hall exuding creativity. And the rest of us were just lucky if we had a notepad and pen and we're walking behind him when he said something brilliant so that we could write it down and execute on it. So the day of the meeting arrives. I get there early. The coffee cart gets there early. I set up easel pads and scented markers on, right? Coffee is the key there, right there. It's like, what's coffee? That's how I felt. It's like, well, my day's good here. I set up easel pads on either side of the room so that whatever Steve said, somebody could capture it. We were always close to an easel pad. So first the clients and the account management team roll in. They're early, like it starts at 9:00. They're at like 8:45, but you know what? Creatives are never early. So it's fine that Steve's not here yet. Then 9:00 rolls around. Everybody else, accounts payable, media, all those guys start rolling in. Still no Steve, but creatives are never on time. And you know what? Everybody's still drinking coffee and they're happy, so we're fine. 9:20, coffee's getting a little colder. People are on the third cup.
Oh, no.
9:40 rolls around and Steve is still not there. And now everybody's sitting at this big conference table staring at me. So I start dialing for dollars because I got to find Steve. So I call the reception to see if he's made it in the building. I call the production floor to see if he's cutting an ad or something. I finally catch him at home, Chris, at home. And I say to him, Steve, what are you doing? Why aren't you here? And he goes, oh, I just didn't feel the mojo today. You're going to have to reschedule that meeting. And he hung up on me. And I turn around and I sit down at the table and I'm sweating and I'm pretty sure I'm about to be fired. And I look at everybody who's now like arms crossed staring at me. And I say, well, Steve's not here. So that's it. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to hide under the table. So this awkward
smile, oh, no.
It was horrible, Chris. It was so bad. Like I still get a little, like my heart rate races as I tell the story. It was such a horrible experience up to this moment. So then there's this awkward silence that fills the room. Nobody says anything. And I'm thinking, I'm done. This is it. And then the most amazing thing happened. So first the person from accounts payable speaks up and they go, hey, I know I just look at the numbers, but I've been seeing this pattern and it made me think of this idea. And then the one who does the media buy spoke up and goes, yeah, I've been seeing this interesting thing that our competition is doing in their media and it gave me this idea. And before I knew it, the room was bubbling with ideas, with incredible innovation without Steve. And that day we set the strategy that led to actually an increase in sales without Steve. And that experience, yeah right? So all this incredible innovation came from all the places you least expect it. All of us who were not innovators, who were not accountable for innovation, who were not responsible for it. But you know what? At the end of the day, we were the ones out there doing the job. So that day really got me thinking, hey, wait a minute. If we understand how we innovate and we're given the room to innovate, maybe this myth that certain people are the innovators is actually wrong. Maybe putting them up on a pedestal doesn't make sense. Maybe it's actually those of us out there doing the work every day that have an incredible opportunity to innovate. So that was my first experience. And then I want to kind of fast forward about 20 years and I'm out and I'm speaking about innovation and I know that everybody innovates and that's the place I'm coming from. But I'm keynoting at a conference, I'm speaking. I get off stage and this woman says to me, love what you talked about. And I was talking about these big concepts, right? Like this type of culture, like give your people X percent of time to do this, make sure this is set up. And I get off stage and this woman comes up to me and she says, that's all great, but how does it apply to me? And that was when all of it kind of came together for me and I realized I see the problem. What we don't have is a tool that helps people recognize how they innovate, their own style of innovation, their archetype, their personality, whatever you want to call it, right? We call it triggers, as you know, in your everyday innovator style. But what people really need is an understanding, truly from a neuroscience, behavioral psychology perspective, of how do we innovate? Because once we understand that, we can actually leverage it and use it and see it in ourselves and see it in others. So that kind of coming together is why I created the assessment. It's because I really wanted to take this subjective, fluffy thing called innovation that most of us cannot connect to and make it real and tangible and empowering for all of us at all levels. And I think you know in your work better than anybody, when everybody in the organization innovates, right, leadership down to front lines and out into the field, that's when major transformation happens. That's when breakthrough outcomes happen. That's when you're able to adapt and change. And that's why the tool was created, because we wanted to make it personal and real and tangible. And I'm really excited to say that that's what's happened. People, it's so funny now, because now when I get off stage or after I'm done with clients or doing whatever it is I'm doing, people will come up to me and say, I didn't even realize I was innovative, but I get it. After seeing this, I totally get it. And that to me is rewarding.
That is actually what I love about this tool is it gives some labels and names to ways that we just lean into problem solving.
Yeah.
Which actually gives me some new language about, like, maybe the way I problem solve is part of the way that I innovate. And as I've seen people use this tool, it's cumulative. Like, the more they start thinking about, hey, that problem solving is actually an innovation, they start leaning into those triggers in their everyday innovation type, and they have language that they can say, hey, I'm coming to this as a collaborative. Can we talk about this idea that I have and how to be able to move it forward? And so that just being able to name it and then also understand it's something I do every day. Like, I do this naturally.
Right. And I love the language you used about leaning in. This is how you innovate is how you create a problem solve. It's how you think differently. It's how you do strategic thinking. It's not about just blue skies, breakthrough. I think that's how we think about innovation. It's about looking a little bit differently at everything you do. And I always talk about it's compounding. So do you remember that exercise we all did in elementary school, understanding compounding interest, where it's like, you put two pennies in the bank and two pennies turns to four and four turns to eight. And so, but that's what this is, right? To your point, when you start to innovate, you start to realize that there's this exponential benefit that comes to you, and you start to see all these places where if you just think a little bit differently, you can actually get incredible results out of it.
So I love the metaphor of compounding interest. So I want to move, keeping with that theme. You know, one of the things that I think is also a challenge is, okay, now I know kind of what I do and I know what other people do on my team. How, from a practical standpoint, how have you seen leadership teams or just teams in general leverage this tool and innovate?
So let me, I'm glad you asked me that, because I think what's been really interesting is that teams have used it in a lot of different ways to gain the traction and the value they need. So let me share with you four.
Perfect.
Give you kind of an overview of how they used it and kind of, I think, why it worked for them, or what they told me of why it worked for them. So the first one is a global electronics company. So they're a reseller of electronics parts, B2B. So not what you'd find in the store, but kind of selling million-dollar contracts to other companies. And the leader of the internal auditing team, so not the marketing team, not the R&D team, but the internal auditing. So these guys are responsible for operational excellence. So crazy smart group of people. They were doing a retreat, but the leader called me and said, hey, so I've got this incredible group of A players. We are excited for the future, but here's where we're a little stuck. We know that we've got new challenges in front of us. We know that what we did yesterday is not going to work tomorrow, but we're not really sure how to shift our thinking and to get the best out of all of us and to bring the innovation out of all of us.
Wow.
So for them, the innovation quotient edge, or IQE, the IQE was all about setting this foundation for the future. All right, we got to move the team into the future thinking. We've got to adjust how we think about our challenges, because frankly, they're new. We can't use yesterday's thinking. How do we do that? And what was really interesting about the process for them is, I think the other thing that they really started to recognize is that everybody brought a unique strength to the table. So in a group of 25, as you know, we had a whole range of different combinations of people's power triggers, their wellspring of innovation, their natural talents around innovation, and the dormant, right, their least powerful trigger and kind of maybe the place they don't play as well. So what this made them realize, though, is not only how to tackle the future and to think differently, but also how to leverage each other best to move forward together as a stronger team. So, but for them, it was all about the future.
That's so great.
Yeah, they're such an amazing team. And, you know, it's interesting because we were talking about them and getting out innovation. And one of them said to me, you know, Tamara, I learned more about myself in our 3 hours together than I have taking all the self-help personal development I've done in the last year. And I thought that was such a huge compliment, because what he was really saying as we dug in was, wow, I really realized how to reach my full potential in a way that I hadn't realized before. And here's the reality, Chris, that you and I think anyone watching this probably realizes, to tackle what's ahead of us, particularly in uncertain changing times, we have got to tap into that potential and that innovation inside of us. So this team set themselves up for success. So that was one. The second is a fast food company. So they're coming from a very different place. The leader called me and said, we've got a real challenge. I've got three mini teams, marketing, R&D, product innovation, that need to come together and really work well if we're going to achieve our goals. But they were stuck in a place where they had no trust. They didn't understand what everybody did. So it was one of those things where we've all fallen into this trap where R&D looks at the people on the marketing team and they go, we do all the work. What are they doing anyway over there? Right? Nobody had any respect or trust for what anybody else was doing on the team. And because of that, there were two really problems. One is there was no collaboration, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But I think the deeper layer on that was, as the leader told me, is that there was a lack of psychological safety and the ability to be vulnerable and take risks. And all that is part of innovation. And as this leader said to me, if we can't get that, we can't reach our objectives. Like,
right.
I as a leader will fail and my teams will fail and we will not hit our numbers, our goals, all of it. So they did their thing with the IQE, and it was so amazing because she called me later and she said, Tamara, she said, I have never seen the team connect in the way they connected in this meeting. She said, having that understanding of how each of us innovate added so much value. She said, but in particular, it was a conversation about how you add value and how you cause friction, which I know that you and I have talked about this in the past, about how important that part is and understanding
right.
that. Because now I get that, Chris, your need to connect and talk and gather this stuff is really you innovating. And Chris, you now understand for me as the risk taker that my need to leap and be uncomfortable is not me being spontaneous and frivolous. It's actually how I innovate. So she said they got to a whole new level of vulnerability and respect and understanding of each other. And now, of course, not only have they reached their goals, but they've actually exceeded them because they're working so beautifully as a team. But I would say that in that example, the key there was getting into the heart of the friction and how to leverage the friction instead of letting them hold them back, which is what was happening in the past. So that's the second one.
Well, so I just wanted to point out there, what I think is also pretty remarkable is something you mentioned earlier that I just want to connect, is the whole thing about what's in it for me. So I think a lot of times we have a hard time collaborating across silos because I can't really see what's in it for me. So if we put a label of innovation on it and all of a sudden you and I have a new way to connect and a new reason to connect, and I can see that my tweaker, you know, that my trigger of tweaking can actually make your idea better and help you leap forward faster. This is where I think that this tool really provides a really unique opportunity and something that I have never seen, that isn't out there. And you know, I've taken every assessment there is.
But as you know, with this one, we wanted to get, this wasn't just about like, who are you? This was about how do you add value and contribute? And how do you use what makes you unique and how you think and use that as your superpower? Right, which is very different than just like, who are you? I want to take a side tangent and share something really quickly.
Yeah.
So we have this one member in our tribe, she's an everyday innovator. And I so appreciate her because she came to me and she said, so I'm this archetype, right? I have these two combinations in my style, but I feel like that's not as cool as the other guy over here with his. And we had this whole conversation about it. And what really she came to realize after taking the assessment and kind of digging in was, oh my gosh, how I innovate is just as powerful as how he innovates. It's just that we put this label on certain types of innovation and innovators, and then we claim these other ones are not that interesting. But the minute she realized that, she dialed it up and she has become such a strong voice on her team. But she needed to realize, and a lot of us do, like, oh, my style is just as valuable as someone over there. They're all equally valuable. It's just a matter of leveraging it. So a little side.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. Great example.
I think we all kind of fall into that trap sometimes of like, I'm not the hoodie guy on the cover of Fast Company, so I'm not creative. It's not true. All right, so the third one is a logistics company. And I just wanted to share this because it's quick but important. So they had this challenge. He came to me and he said, I don't think we have the right people on the bus. And I want to make sure we do. And as you and I know, I'm very big that this is not a tool about who is or isn't right. It's about how do you leverage all the different types of innovators.
Right.
And what was very cool about how he used it in this experience was that what actually came out of his experience with this team wasn't, do I have the right people on the bus, but have I designed the bus in a way that leverages my people? So what he meant to do was see if he had the right people. Yeah. What came out of it was, oh, am I leveraging all this diversity of thinking on my bus? And have I created a bus that actually fosters all these different unique styles of innovation? So the trap he fell into, which a lot of us as leaders do, is we push everybody into one lane of innovation. It all has to look this way, right? It's the flavor of the month process. It's the flavor of the month initiative, whatever it is. And what he really realized was the bus itself needed to be redesigned. He had amazing people. He wasn't leveraging them. And I was so glad because
I love that.
Yeah. I was so excited when he called me back because, as you can imagine, it's the fact that he kind of came to that realization of the bus design matters just as much. And I think, you know, from years of reading Jim Collins' work, we talk about the right people on the bus, but that's only half the conversation, in my opinion.
That's perfect.
Not always the right one. I think we mostly have the right people. We're not tapping them.
Right. I love that example.
Okay. So my last one is a credit union. And this is actually extremely recent. So as you can imagine with COVID, credit unions, banks are going through a major transformation.
Yeah.
And the leader of this one regional credit union, very successful credit union, but he called me and he said, here's our problem, Tamara. What we do isn't irrelevant. People need money. They need to house their money. Money transactions are going to happen. He said, however, how we do it has become irrelevant overnight. So the way they serve their customers, the way their employees work, what they do, that was their biggest battle. And he's got all these leaders in the field. And he said, what I really need to do is give them the confidence and the tools to drive innovation out in the field where I'm not every single day. I'm over here telling them to innovate and to drive change and to pivot fast. That was his big thing. We've got to pivot fast. We cannot afford to take a long time. And the way they use the IQE was to give the leaders in the field their everyday innovator styles and then to use that to drive innovation with their teams across the organization. So this really was about supporting their leaders out in the field. But ultimately, the goal was fast pivoting because it had to happen. They didn't have a choice. And he was getting resistance in places that he didn't expect. And we can talk about the mental resistors of change in a minute. But for him, like he needed the organization's mindset to shift with him. And he was getting resistance before. And after doing that, and those people in the field realizing they're innovators, not just operators, but they're also innovators, that helped his leaders get the support they needed to make that happen.
Well, and I can see the connection between the mindset shift and the opportunity to think differently about my contribution. So it put some kind of de-emphasizes the change and says, no, I'm actually up to this challenge and I'm going to move forward. Yeah. And when time is so crucial, that's amazing.
You know, it's interesting that you said that because one of the things he said to me was, and originally I was getting phone calls of like, well, my employees are asking me if I can wear jeans now that were more casual. And he was like, I don't want to have that conversation. Like, you make those decisions of what's right for your community. Like, why are you calling me about this micro stuff, right? But it's because they're insecure, they're nervous, they've got a lot of fear about what's coming. Right. He said, after they kind of, to your point, recognize that, oh, hey, I can deal with this, but things change. And I think as you well know too, from seeing the IQE reports, we're very big on action. So we always have tools inside the report of, hey, here's how you can dial this up every single day. His team just needed the confidence and then some tools to help them get them on their way. And that's what we gave them. And we're really excited to say that they're leading the way in credit unions and what's gonna come next.
Oh, that's so awesome. So those are great stories and great examples that really help ground the benefit of understanding how you individually innovate and then how you work together as a team. So when you, I know that in your first book, Thinking Sideways, and your marketing and advertising background and experience, that you have thought a lot about how to get people unstuck, which means you've also done the research about what makes us stuck.
Yeah.
So can you give us a couple of examples of like, where do organizations get hung up on trying to innovate as a verb or a noun or something? Like, oh, that means I have to stop what I'm doing now, turn over here and innovate.
So I just wrote down what I wanted to make sure to cover. So let me look at my notes for a second. But I love the way you said that of like, stop everything, which I think is one of our biggest mistakes, right? So, and I'm going to tackle that in the first one. So let me tell you what the four are and then I'll dig in. So
okay.
The first one is a lack of clarity and a heaviness around innovation. I mean, that's kind of what you were alluding to. The second one is there's actually four traps of certainty. I'm going to talk about two of them today, the certain people, certain times. The third one is a lack of understanding of the neuroscience and the actual resistors of change that we all have hardwired into our brains. And because of that, we get super frustrated at our teams when they don't move with us. And then the fourth one is this trap of presentation versus experimentation and the culture of each. So let me kind of break those down, of those four. So the first one, the lack of clarity and the heaviness. So here's the thing. If we went and asked, and I challenge anyone watching this video, go ask 10 people their definition of innovation, and you will get 10 different answers that have zero crossover and probably 10 answers from one person. We do not have a common way to talk about innovation.
Right.
Because of that, there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of missed expectations, a lot of frustration. Because Chris, you come to me, you're my leader in the team, and you say, we're gonna innovate, and you and I aren't even starting from the same place.
Oh, good point.
Yeah, so, and I'm gonna layer onto that, that there's a lot of baggage around it, which makes it heavy, because to what you said, what I feel like you're telling me is I've gotta walk away from this pile of stuff I have on my desk that keeps the ship moving forward and move over here to some like blue skies area. And so now I'm wandering in blue skies. I don't know where to look. I don't know where to go. And in the back of my head, what I'm really thinking is, this is exhausting. And what am I supposed to do with this stuff when I get back to the box I'm in, right? So those two things shut us down. So it's part of the reason why, so in my book, Innovation is Everybody's Business, I spend a lot of time talking about what is the definition of innovation that we can actually get a common language, a common starting point, and empowers all of us to be innovative. So let me just share what that definition is. So not all left with like, well, what do we do tomorrow? Great point, but now what?
Buy the book.
And look for this definition. I don't remember what page it's on. So the definition is this. And know, by the way, that this has come from 25 years of work and experience of understanding the neuroscience of innovation, cultures of businesses. We wanted to give people a definition that was based in real world, not in textbook.
Right.
And it's this. So thinking differently about what's right in front of you to create a competitive advantage. That's it. So thinking differently, a shift in perspective, a new way to look at something. I think the key nugget in there for a lot of people though is what's right in front of you, right? The problems, the challenges, the tasks, the opportunities, the resources, the team, all of it. We have found that rearranging the box is more powerful than outside the box. So what's-
Oh, cool.
Just what's right in front of you. You'll create even more breakthrough just by doing that. And here's the cool part, Chris, you and I both know, right? That sometimes a tiny little shift in how you innovate, how you do your job, has a ripple effect and an impact that is just as powerful as creating some breakthrough product. So all of it matters. All of it is, I think you said in the beginning of this discussion, all of it's part of innovation. So that helps us get over this lack of clarity where you're like, tomorrow, go innovate. And then I bring you what I think is innovation. And you as my leader are frustrated because I didn't bring you what you wanted. And I'm frustrated because I always let you down. So we're going to get over that hurdle by having a common starting point, and we're gonna get over the heaviness of it and make it easy. There's no reason why innovation has to be hard, complicated, behind a black curtain. That's just a myth that consulting companies like to sell you because then you need them.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah, so the second one is, in my book, I talk about the four traps. Just in the essence of time, I'm gonna talk about two that are really relevant and you can read the other four.
Okay.
So I've mentioned this multiple times. We buy into this myth that it's for certain people. Here's the challenge for companies when that happens. We silo innovation and we actually shut it down really heavily. So let me share a story behind this. So I was doing this workshop with a group of people from various companies. And a woman came up to me from a national law firm. And she said, let me ask you a question, Tamara. This is what my company has done. They recognize they need to be innovative. So they created a cross-functional team. And that team's job is to kind of assess the organization, where we have room for innovation, go do their thing, come back, tell us where we need to innovate, and then we're supposed to implement. What do you think about that? Is that a good idea? So obviously I had some words or some thoughts in my head, but I thought I'd stop and ask her first, well, how do you feel about that? Chris, her whole body just slumped over when she answered. She said, honestly, it makes me feel pretty bad. She said, why aren't they asking me? I'm out here doing the work every single day, but my ideas aren't valued enough to be part of the process. Only these five people get to. So now she said, I'm more demoralized and less motivated than I have ever been at my job, because in doing that, she said, they basically told me my ideas don't matter, that I'm not innovative. But again, I'm the one doing the work. So when we buy into this myth that it's certain people, not only are we not tapping the 10, hundreds, thousands, whatever you have, people who are doing the work, which frankly as a leader, why would you tap five when you could tap 500, right? But also, there's this really unfortunate side effect of you're actually shutting them down and disengaging everybody else who you told is not the innovative ones. And I don't think we realize we do that. And that is a big trap that companies fall into that create this kind of brick wall when they're trying to innovate. So they put in this initiative, but in doing so, they actually, it's like one step forward, 1,000 steps back.
Good point. Yep. Yeah.
So the next one is the lack of understanding of resistors. Here's the thing. The brain has this incredible ability to innovate. So the neuroscience has shown us we actually all have the structures for innovation. And by the way, the structures for intelligence and innovation are actually distinct. So the cool part about that is your years of experience, your VP title, your certifications, your IQ, I don't even know what mine is. Your ability to innovate doesn't rely on that.
And we exactly.
I know. Thank God for people like me. So we all have it, and it's a whole brain experience. So it's kind of like, do you know those images you see from like the space station at night where the Earth is lit up and you've got all these lights connecting across different cities? That's what's happening in our brain. So that's the cool part. But then on the other side, we've got these resistors, and I'll talk very quickly about the three main ones. So one, we've got this thing called the reticular activating system. So I think of this as the brick wall, the RAS. The brick wall is there to only allow in things that you already believe in or think to be true. And the challenge with that is it's hard to innovate when you're only letting in what you already know to be true. It's why when you decide to buy a blue car, you suddenly notice every blue car on the road where you thought there were no blue cars before, right? So we got to open up the bricks in that wall so that we can see new things. The second one is the thing called the myelin trap. So in short, myelin is this wiring or this coating over our tracks in our brain. It makes us super efficient and fast. The challenge is it also keeps us on the same path because it wants us to be, our brain is lazy. It wants us to be efficient. The third one and the biggest one I find, and this is what's happening for leaders with teams, and this is why you're getting such pushback on change and innovation, is the lizard brain. That primal part of our brain, it wants to keep us safe and comfortable and warm, and it doesn't want us to take risks. And it's the little brain, it's almost like this little gatekeeper to the higher functioning that we really need. And it's over there going, don't do it. It'll never work. Don't bother. This is going to be way too much work. Ooh, this sounds exhausting. Let's not go there. And the key that I think we have to understand as leaders is we have to understand what's going on in our team's brain so that we can actually overcome them. And I talk a lot about this in my book. You and I have talked, we could probably have an entire other session about this. But I think the thing to know is if you understand that there are some brain resistors actually happening, they're actually pretty easy to overcome. And I'll share a little bit at the end about this has been happening on my team lately with everything too, where I went and presented change to them and I got surprising pushback. And I was like, well, we're in the business of innovation. What's happening here? And then I realized, oh yeah, this is just these brain resistors that we need to figure out how to get over so that we can get to the place of pivoting fast. But
well, I think, oh, I was just gonna add, cause you know, I'm a brain science freak too. Yeah. But I think the important point here is that it's not just one brain function.
that as, especially as we age into our 30s, and that myelin has formed over our brain.
Coding.
Exactly. And societal pressures, everything from economics to social pressures to company pressures, wherever you work, all reinforce this sort of fixed perspective. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just one part of your brain, it's many parts of your brain, and it's many parts of our external environment that actually make it even more threatening, you know, really empowering that lizard part of our brain to be like, no way, I'm not going to take that risk. I'm not going to, that is big chance, you know, that's a chance I'm not willing to take.
So I want to tell you one quick story that I think wraps up all three of these into one.
Okay. It's like
a personal story, but it made me realize how often this is happening to all of us and to leaders, to your teams on a really subconscious level that we don't even realize. We're not over there consciously thinking, I fear change. It's just happening, right?
Right.
So we've got this, I have two boys, they're 11 and 15, and we've got this restaurant that we've been going to since they were in high chairs. And we know the staff, we know the menu, they know, we don't even have to order, they just bring us what we always get, right? And it's become our Saturday routine. So one Saturday, my oldest is sitting in the front seat and he turns to me and he says, Mom, hey, there's that new restaurant down the street, what do you say we try that restaurant instead? You would have thought he was asking me to move across the globe tomorrow. I looked at him, I was like, oh, Liam, I was like, I don't know. I mean, maybe we should just go, maybe we should just go to the restaurant we always go to. I mean, we don't know if the food's any good. Do we really want to risk it? Like, we should just, let's just go to the Greek place we always go to.
Wow.
I know, such resistance for me. And he looks at me and he goes, is the risk of having a bad meal really that bad? Is it really that much of a risk? And in that moment, I realized my lizard brain, my myelin, right, who have put me into this fast track of we go to the same restaurant, I know what to eat, right, everything is efficient. The brick wall, the RAS that was like, you know, do what you know, do what you love, had just taken over in that moment. And it really made me realize how subconscious a lot of this is for us, and that we really need to work with our teams on this brain level to get them over that hurdle. And for me, when I think about companies, it's a big resistor to change because this mandate comes down and you're pushing up against this brick wall that you don't understand how to get over. So there's just a lot of friction and frustration. When we need to be thinking is, how do we get around the wall? How do we go under the wall? How do we go through the wall? But we don't know how, we just see it as frustrating resistance.
Yeah, so that's a perfect segue into like getting real and getting personal. I know that since March, I've definitely embraced every part of the change cycle where I was in deep denial that anything was happening and that
the exactly.
And then I was like in resistance, like this isn't going to be me and it's only going to be a couple weeks and then it's going to be fun. I'll be back on the road.
And finally, as I navigated into exploration, it was actually really freeing from a mental perspective to let go of the past. That isn't to say that I don't, you know, think back to what my business plan looked like in January compared to now.
Right.
Like it's really changed. But then also, what, you know, moving into that commitment phase of like, I'm committed to a new normal and working with my clients and with my team members. So tell us a little bit about you since March. What have you had to do to innovate?
Yeah, it has been a fascinating road. And I will tell you, Chris, there are days where I felt like I hit every point of that curve you just talked about.
Yep.
Day. Like it wasn't a linear path. I felt like I jumped a lot all over the place.
Sure.
So here's the thing. And I'll be fully kind of transparent about this because I think our journey and all of our journeys are actually really important to share because we have a level of urgency to innovate that we simply never had before. And, you know, we've always talked in the past about disrupt or be disrupted, innovate or die, right? All those catchphrases. And they were true to a point because we were still kind of on a momentum that we could at least sustain or thought we could sustain, or the curve down was slow. And then this happened, right, overnight. So, as you know, if I look at my plan that I built in November of 2019, which is not that long ago, as I was going into the next year, my business, the Launch Street, and all of this work, while built on this technology, was really about live events. So keynotes, workshops, team meetings, right? All of that facilitation. And I'd always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to have a more scalable, more online-driven business, but I hadn't made it happen because this side of the business was doing well and paying bills and then some, right? So why would I shift when this is working? But that rug got pulled out from under me. So, I mean, just really did. I mean, as anyone who's in any event business, hospitality, right? So think about what's happening with restaurants and hotels. That's what happened to my business. The whole thing just got shut down. Every event we had in 2020 was basically canceled, more or less. So I had to really think about how am I going to move forward? Because what I found with people and with myself is that we're really two camps. Camp one was, I'll just wait it out. We'll get back to normal. Things are going to come back. Obviously not the camp to be in. Well, that's the reality, right? I mean, when this started, Chris, I thought we were going to be home for 2 weeks.
Me too. Yes.
Apparently not. But what I also kind of slowly came, or maybe not slowly, quickly came to realize was if I didn't pivot, my business not only was going to suffer, but maybe not survive. And a lot of people are that regardless of how fruitful your business was going into this, this shook the ground for all of us. Excuse me. So I had a choice to make. I could be in that camp one or I could be in camp two, which said, okay, our reality is that things are not going to come back to normal. That whatever existed before is not what's going to exist in the future. So I've got to pivot my business, and I'm talking my entire model, not just take live stuff and turn it virtual. So that's where I started, and I was spinning my wheels because all I was doing was taking what I was doing and just going, slapping an online label on it, right? And that's
right.
And when you think about whatever business we're in, just slapping a new label on it doesn't do it.
No.
I learned that quickly. Nope. So what I really realized in all of it was I had to shift the business model actually there's three things that came together. I had to shift the business model. My customers, my clients now had new challenges and needs and expectations they didn't have before. And I had to figure out how to match that. And there were new opportunities that weren't there before. So it was like this beautiful Venn diagram that came together in a mm-hmm. lot of challenge, frustration, and sweat and tears and all over the curve. And so we took our business model and we did what I would say is what we train other people to do is we jump the curve. So every business has a life cycle and has a curve. Most of the time, the curve feels slow until you hit the decline and then you're like, oh my God, what do I do?
Right.
And for a lot of us in this scenario, we were hitting this curve and then it just hit a cliff. But the reality is you can't incrementally improve the curve you're on. That leads to more failure and more frustration. Maybe you'll elongate it a little bit, but you're still on the downside. So what we had to figure out is how do we jump the curve and create a new one? And that's what we did. And it was tough and challenging and hard, but so we built this thing called the Everyday Innovators Tribe, which is a membership platform, which took all the awesome juiciness of what we do and put it into this new method and this new approach. But here's the trick to this. This is the little value bomb I want to give all of us. To jump your curve, you can't think about what you do and how to innovate off that. You have to think about the benefit of what you do, the benefit you provide. So if I tried to innovate and change off of live workshops, events, all of that, I would have just slapped the label of virtual on it. That's not a new curve. I had to go, okay, the real benefit that we provide is enabling people to innovate, enabling teams to be high performing, making innovation accessible and real, right? Just in a nutshell. That is what we decided to think about. And when we thought about that, that's where we got to this membership and this kind of whole new platform. And it is doing, I'm really happy to say, it's doing even better than we expected. We are getting people from across the globe. So our reach is bigger, our impact is bigger than it was before. And people are getting actually way more out of it because a live event, you're in and out, right? And now I'm with them with all these great offerings over an extended period of time. We're doing jam sessions online. They're getting bursts of innovation. We've got this community page, like all this is happening. But all that is to say is it took the rug getting pulled out from under us that we had to really think differently. And I think that the challenge we got to really think about as leaders is, are we really just trying to improve the curve we're on, which is going away, whether we like it or not, it's going away. At some point it's going away. Or are we jumping the curve and leveraging what we have to create something new?
Well, and I think as I'm thinking back through this whole conversation, a couple things I just really want to land on in terms of your story. So the first one is that you had the courage and the willingness to actually think differently about what was right in front of you. So I want to make that connection directly to the definition you gave us earlier about innovation, because you were able to have several moments where you were like, that's not happening to me, to, holy crap, this is happening to me.
Oh my God, how it is.
Yeah, exactly. And to be able to like really examine and say, okay, I'm going to think differently. I'm going to have the willingness and the ability, the tenacity, the persistence, actually, to be able to look at what I have and figure out how to work with this in a different way. And you embraced years and years and years of research about brain science, research about teams, working with leaders, like all of your, you brought all of that experience. So I want to make the point that innovation isn't, and you made it earlier, but just to restate it, innovation is not about abandoning all of your lived and learned experience in the interest of something else. It's actually bringing all of that to bear on looking at that current challenge in a new way, to be able to have the courage to be able to think about that and look at it differently.
And Chris, I want to add one thing to that. I love the way you said that. Like, it is not about walking away. It's about leveraging how you innovate and all the experience that got you to where you are today. And jumping the curve isn't even about walking away. It's about reapplying, right, in a new way. But I want to say, I think there's an incredible opportunity right now. And I would never wish kind of the uncertainty and the challenges that we've had on any of us. But here's the thing. So we jumped into experimentation mode fast. And I think one of the challenges a lot of companies have, they get stuck in presentation mode. So they're like analysis paralysis, perfection paralysis, right? Like they just get stuck. Yeah. Let's think about what to do. Where we chose to say, let's build these innovation cycles and let's experiment and experiment and experiment until we get it right. And part of the leeway that we have right now, more so than ever, is we have permission to innovate and make mistakes with our customers because we are all going through this together. And right. And I'm not saying we should be sloppy by any means, but we're on this journey together. And we really used that to everybody's advantage, including our customers. They'll tell you they're getting a better product out of us because we're playing together to figure out how this all works. And I think we get this, make the mistake of we've got to get it right out of the gate. And that leads to ideas getting stuck on paper and not in the real world. So I think it's really important that we take this, how we innovate and these cultures that we build, and actually experiment and do something with them as well.
That is, I really want to emphasize that because I think that's a perfect note to end on, is that experimentation actually helps us understand our own power triggers better. And those are the people around us. And to me, that's where I also get peripheral vision. So when I'm actually experimenting, I'm not so locked up in my head and my ideas, which that's actually one of my preferences is intuitive. So I can just stay like my intuitive belief that something's like that's going to happen. It's only when I really prototype, experiment, get feedback, work with other people on that. And you're absolutely correct. Like there's no better time than right now to really be able to lean into that and to collaborate with your clients and customers in ways that help you jump the curve. Because I think that that's the other piece, is that sometimes I get very nervous because that jump seems pretty big, but when it's a collective effort and I don't have to do it by myself, then I'm more likely to actually take that risk and then deal with the consequence.
Right. Yeah. And you know, here's the thing about it. It's big and small at the same time.
Right.
And that's I think the beauty in it. But you have to, and here's what makes it big. It's when you don't experiment and then you launch after being in the conference room for way too long. When you experiment and go from one experiment to the next, and an experiment can be some duct tape and scented markers, by the way. An experiment doesn't need to be the whole thing. You right. can start really small, work your way up. That, and to your point, it's amazing what you find in the what works and what doesn't and the innovation when you start to actually build stuff out and make it happen. You see your thinking in a way that you can't see when it's on paper. And I know you got to start somewhere, but that experimentation is a huge part of innovation. And if we look at the companies and the teams and the leaders that are doing well right now or who are managing and leveraging the change, I guarantee you, you'll find a common theme of not just having the power of the diversity of thinking on their team, which is huge, but also leveraging that to take action.
That's it. That's a total wrap. Yeah, like being able to experiment, take advantage of the people that you have on your team. That whole idea of like redesign the bus if the bus isn't right, but you have the right people and can leverage their triggers and how they innovate. And then also not to be afraid of the challenges that are ahead of you, but know that you have both the capacity. But I think the other thing that the IQE has given me is like the willingness to really look into the kind of change that I want to make. And be able to persist and feel confident in making those changes.
I love it. Well, thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and the background around IQE.